back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with the movers and shakers, those film and TV makers, the producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, film editors, sound editors, sound mixers, sound designers, costume designers, production designers, VFX gurus, composers, you name it. And we talk to them. And you all know how much I love to talk. So this week, though, it's all about horror as we take a look at two distinctly different types of horror films. One that is dark and twisted and steeped in ancient lore and curses, called Rosario. The other, a lighter tone horror film that may have you rethinking getting yourself a cute, cuddly puppy, but horror nevertheless, and with a bit of action thrown in. And that film is A Breed Apart. First up, you're going to hear my exclusive interview with the first brothers, Nathan and Griff, co-writers, co-directors, and co-editors of A Breed Apart. A Breed Apart is the tale of a group of social media influencers who find themselves on a private island owned by the famous Vince Ventura, expecting a weekend of unrivaled viral opportunity. It doesn't take long before our five quote-unquote contestants find themselves as part of their own horrific reality show when the guests are pitted against each other to capture the island's legendary man-eating dogs before they become victims of the monstrous canines, succeed and win $1 million and the island itself. Plus, you're doing wonders for pet adoption. Who can resist? A Breed Apart stars, among others, Hayden Panettiere, Virginia Gardner, Grace Carolyn Curry, and my favorite, Paige Kennedy, who most of you will probably recognize from the Meg franchise. You know, the huge shark, Steve Alton's books made into movies starring Jason Statham. And they all star in this harrowing tale of terror. And there's a lot of laughs that are thrown in here, of course, but there are some really tense and scary moments. As you'll hear, we go ahead and the first brothers and I break down A Breed Apart, discussing the genesis of the film, the production, themes, and challenges, including the film's meta-narrative and focus on social media influencers, which in and of itself provides some wonderful subtextual commentary. As to be expected, a big part of our conversation goes to the dogs, as the brothers give us the scoop on the canine aspect of the film. 10 real dogs were used during filming, supplemented by CGI dogs, so at times it looked like 50 to 60 dogs. The real dogs were trained by 6 trainers. They were particularly good at swimming. So there are swimming scenes. There's a lake scene. This is shot on location in Guatemala, in Atitlan, Guatemala. There's a beautiful lake there, high up in the mountains, very tropical. But you will see in the water scenes, yes, it's the real dogs, and they're actually swimming, which meant that the camera operators and the trainers had to get in the water as well. You're going to be fascinated, I think, to hear Nathan and Griff talk about that aspect of the production. And the dogs themselves were actually very nice. So the real dogs looked too happy and friendly, which meant that Nathan Griff and Griff, who did their own editing, ended up using over 1,500 visual effect shots to make the dogs look menacing. That alone required meticulous and extensive post-production. And the film actually now holds a record for the number of visual effect shots in an independent film of a certain budget, I believe. But you'll hear the brothers talk about that. That is a little bit of trivia to be very proud of, about with when you have a film. And you're also going to hear them talk about the logistic challenges of filming in Atitlan, Guatemala, as well as Santa Catarina, Palopo. There are two locations in Guatemala that they use, and they're very distinguishable. So when you see the film, you'll know which is which. And one of the big problems with the logistic challenges in the quote-unquote action sequences, there are trails through the jungles that required camera operators to be running behind or beside the actors and dogs. Narrow trails, not big, jungle. And just to get to this location, the crew had to drive 3 hours from civilization, then get on a boat and sail to reach the shooting locations. Then the camera operators and crew had to hike equipment up hills and navigate the tropical landscape. This is an incredible... When you hear Nathan and Griff talk about the production, it might give you a better sense of what they went through, what dedicated filmmakers go through to make a film. And this is just a smattering of what you're about to hear. So I'm going to shut up, and you can take a listen as Nathan First and Griff First give us all the ins and outs of A Breed Apart. Talk about a fun film! I had so much fun watching this movie. It is so entertaining. You have you have palpable terror and tension. You keep your visual tonal bandwidth light and bright in contrast to the terror that's unfolding thanks to these maniacal dogs. But it picks up on the comedy. We get rapier comedic notes. It's very stylized in the shooting, in the angles. You've got some guerrilla style filming in there as we're chasing dogs or being chased by dogs. Fast paced. This is just really a job so well done, guys.
Thank you so much. We're so pleased you liked it.
What led you to telling this next chapter in the Breed quote unquote saga, so to speak?
Familiar with the original Breed film that was released in 2006, and a partner of ours who distributed many of our films internationally came to us with this idea, and they had the rights to the original Breed, and they said, hey, do you want to make a sequel to this thing? And so we watched it because we hadn't seen it, and the thought process was that the 2006 version, while it was a cool movie, especially for 2006, it didn't feel like we could make that same kind of movie in 2025.
Mm-hmm.
And so and Nathan's great at coming up with original ideas. And I said, well, how can we twist this so that it's fun to make and fun to watch? And he had the idea of making it a movie within a movie and calling the original Breed was a movie. And it was kind of the origin of how this island got all the dogs on it. And so once we had that idea, we just kind of hit the ground running on this more comedic, meta version of that same story.
I absolutely love the fact you took it to the next level, and especially more or less what I think so much of the world would love to see, a lot of these social influencers get totally skewered or chomped or turned into kibble. And that is part of the hilarity in this film, that you're using these social media influencers and bringing them under the cultish spell of money, thanks to Vince Ventura, who is brilliantly played by Joey Bragg. Your casting there was perfect.
Yeah, I think Joey did a great job. And it's like, I've actually seen a lot of horror movies as of recently that take influencers or creators and kind of give them this very kind of surface caricature of who influencers are to then set them up and kill them. And we kind of wanted to... enhance what we've seen other filmmakers who cast influencers in there by giving them actual personality and feelings.
Yes.
Especially up to contrast recently, and we're embracing that culture, and we try to make that part of it organic because we're friends with several content creators, and it's its own art form that's separate from film, and so we kind of wanted to highlight that you know they have a purpose too, and they just have opposing viewpoints, Violet and Collins, and that they're kind of our voice of the of those conflicting artists who have different formats and do different things.
We thought
it would be fun to sort of start out playing into that trope of just sort of like, oh, we're going to set up these influencers and we're going to kill them. And we sort of do set up a lot of those kind of things. But then as the movie goes, the idea was, yes, a lot of those stereotypes are true. But then there's this undercurrent of like seeing these people three-dimensionally for who they are. Mm-hmm. And we kind of wanted to bring that out in the midst of them running for their lives.
Couple of them, as we see, they have great value underneath their surface on-screen persona. The on-screen social media persona. I love the depth that you give to Violet in particular. She's fantastic. The character of Nathan Kelly, I got to tell you, from the beginning, I'm rooting for him to become Kibble. And you taunt me and you tease me. A killer queen. Queen is she's fantastic, as is Violet. But, you know, the character that I really love and that I was looking forward to in this film, and you did not disappoint, is Paige Kennedy as Farmer Jay. Paige Kennedy brings to A Breed Apart exactly what he brings to the Meg franchise. He's one of the most enjoyable parts of that franchise. He is one of the most enjoyable, fun parts here.
He's always got that energy going. He always sacrifices himself for the movie too. I think he busted his ankle running from dogs at some point or something.
Yeah, he wasn't running from dogs. No, he was resetting.
He was resetting. Okay. That's right. He was resetting. That's what it was.
But
one of those steps.
He kept going.
But he kept going, man. He strapped up that leg and he kept going. And so there's a lot of those shots where he's being funny and he's being loose. And what you can't see is he's actually got his leg strapped up under there. So the dude's a champ, and he's funny as hell.
And he's probably laughing to cover up the pain that he's in.
He's just always laughing. He's always laughing. He wasn't in pain. He's just a trooper.
He wasn't in pain.
They all were, actually. They all were. They all were down to sort of just go for it. I mean, I think each one of them took some sort of a bruise or something just for the team, diving and running and just going for it. They're all hardcore champs, and... And every time we said, "Are you sure?" they're like, "No, I want to do it." Okay, great. So when you see that driving that crazy golf cart with dogs running alongside sometimes, that's actually Jenny Gardner.
Wow.
That thing, everybody in there, yeah, it's crazy.
Wow. Well, I have to imagine that everybody, and probably crew included, took some bumps and bruises on this shoot. Number one, your location in Guatemala is beautiful, absolutely beautiful. But that presents a lot of logistic challenges for you in terms of your camera work and that guerrilla style that you have, even though you can clearly see their paths they're following. When you're trying to bring in a dolly track or Steadicam or something and you've got camera operators that are having to run and follow, that's a tenuous situation. So I'm curious.
Great observation. That's dead on. That's dead on. That's exactly right.
We had very athletic camera operators. In those locations, not only were they a three-hour drive from civilization, but once you got there, you had to load onto a boat, and they were only accessible by boat. So the whole crew had to get on a boat, take a ferry over to the location, unload the dolly track, hike it up a hill to get some of those locations, which is just the nature of, you know, the smaller budget. We can't build that thing. If it was a studio picture, we would for sure be building all of those sets so that they were easier to shoot. But in order to get those looks that we wanted, we had to trek to it, which was an adventure in and of itself. We had a very courageous cast and crew who were down to all be mini versions of Indiana Jones going out and making it happen.
It just amazed me at the word, you're right, it is athleticism, of the camera operators as they are following what's happening, especially once we get dogs in there. Now, I got to ask you about the dogs. I know you have some real dogs there, but obviously we've got some CGI or possibly even some AI dogs happening. Talk to me about the dog situation here. Because I got to tell you, some of those, like the little puppy shepherd, oh God, you just want to take that little bugger home.
Yeah, we didn't want to take him home. He was a cute guy. So we had 10 real dogs with us for the whole show. And when you see shots with a massive amount of dogs in it, if you look really closely, 10 of them are real.
Mm-hmm.
And then surrounded by CGI dogs. But the problem, which other people who have made movies with a bunch of dogs have experienced the same thing, is that they look very happy because they're treated well and they're given lots of treats. And so when they're supposed to be scary, no matter how much fake blood you put on them, they're wagging their tails. So we ended up, by accident, setting the world record for the most visual effects in a movie, in an independent movie ever. Of course, Marvel movies will have more shots, but we had over 1,500 shots, and we had that verified by a company called Record Setter. We sent them all our thing and all our research, and the only other movie that's close is Cloverfield, which was actually a $20 million movie,
oh.
And they had 800 shots in it.
Technically independent, though, I guess?
It's independent, yeah.
Oh.
So it was, once we got into post and we said this dog looks too happy, we had to start really digging in and prescribing more visual effects shots than we initially intended. Because the story you see was the script. It's a crazy script. It's just nonstop action.
Right.
In order to make that happen, we had to really lean on visual effects.
But it works. It works. Now, what about the dogs in the water? Was that all CGI?
No, those are practical, actually. Believe it or not. A lot of those dogs are practical. I think most of them are, actually. Yeah, I think most of the dogs in the water are practical. They were good swimmers, and so the trainers we had... I think we had 6 trainers with the 10 dogs at all times, and so the boat was actually parked on the dock and tied to the dock.
Mm-hmm.
And half the trainers would go out on a little peninsula, and then the other trainer, the main trainer that the dogs would come to, would get on the boat and just blow his whistle, and they'd all jump in and start swimming towards the boat.
Oh my God.
It's all part of the whole movie magic trickery. For the most part, they're never more than a few feet away from the dock.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like they're just swimming,
It does.
Out at sea, but, they're just swimming from one side of the dock to the other.
That looks amazing. And I'm just blown away that it was the real dogs in there doing that.
They were cool. It's so funny. There were a lot of things they didn't necessarily want to do, like snarl or growl or look scary. But swimming, for whatever reason, they were game. And that's all up in Lake Atitlan in this beautiful... So to have these things where you have, like, maybe 6-7 dogs at a time swimming in the water, and you can run the camera on a boat and just follow them, and in the background you have this, like, beautiful tropical island landscape. We were very lucky to have that set up.
Wow. Well, showcasing that beautiful tropical landscape, that falls on your cinematographer, John Kang.
Amazing. We love
John is, he did such a fantastic job on Audrey's Children, the drama that just came out a couple months ago. So to see him now embracing A Breed Apart and working with you, I've got totally different tone, totally different visual grammar. So I'm curious about your conversations with John in developing your visual grammar for this film, to capture everything that you did, because you've got some tight spaces, you've got wide open spaces, you've got narrow trail paths. This could not have been easy for you to plot out with him in terms of lighting and lensing.
Well, that was one of the reasons that we landed on John was his ability and enthusiasm for doing that kind of shoot.
Yeah, when we found him, actually, there's a few cinematographers that we typically work with, and they ended up not being available. So we went in and we probably watched over 100 cinematography reels.
Mm-hmm.
And John's was just such a huge standout. His work really just jumped off the screen. And so we called him up and met with him, and he loves shooting in this style. He loves going to adventurous locations and shooting this kind of movie. And he was the ideal partner for something as ambitious as this. I don't know if we could have pulled it off with somebody else besides John.
Wow. Now, I've got one last question for you because I'm getting texted, gotta wrap. Gotta ask you about the editing got to ask you on the editing process on this one, guys, because you did your own editing. Now, were you editing as you went? Did you wait till you have all the footage accumulated and then start your editing process? Talk to me.
Until we got back to the States, because we were going as hard as we can while we were in production. I think we both enjoy editing, but it was a very tough movie to edit, which is why we edited ourselves, because there was so many visual effects that I'm not. If we had an editor, we'd have to be with them 24/7 anyways, because there were so many visual effects plates. It'd be very difficult for an editor to understand what to cut, even with all the proper slating and descriptions. It's just there's too many shots of nothing where something extraordinary was supposed to be happening. And so because we knew that, and, I mean, the organization involved in 1,500-plus VFX shots is a whole task in and of itself. So it was a technical and organizational feat, which is why we jumped in and said, let's just edit this thing so that we can get it done and delivered on time.
Oh, my God. Well, job well done, guys. I got to know, am I going to get a sequel?
Let's see how well it does. Yeah. Blast it out to all your followers and tell them to rent it. I think if it ends up in the top 10, you might see a sequel.
I am already chomping at the bit for a sequel. As soon as it cut to black before the end credits started, which are fabulous, by the way. I love seeing all the BTS stuff throughout
It was fun, right?
Yeah, a lot of fun.
So it really shows how much fun the cast and crew bonded and had a blast just really coming together and making this happen.
I'm waiting and wanting a sequel to this, guys. I'll be the first one there to see it, if you make it.
All right. Well, the movie's out today, and the soundtrack is out. You can listen to all the things, and if it gets enough attention, you know, we definitely have ideas for a sequel.
I bet you do.
You never know. We'll see.
Oh, guys, thank you so much. This has been great fun, and I hope I get to chat with you again in the future.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Nathan and Griff First talking about A Breed Apart. It is in theaters and available on demand and on digital right now. It just released on Friday. And I'm already chomping at the bit for a sequel. I'll tell you that much. And I think you will be too, because it's a lot of fun. The tone is actually light and bright, which is contrast to the menacing dogs, but it also aids in some of the humor. Sometimes sick and twisted humor, but humor nonetheless. Go see it. Sit at home and see it. Go to the theater and see it. I think you're really going to enjoy it. And yes, I think you're going to want a sequel too. But now we're going to switch gears and we're going to go deep and dark with director Felipe Vargas talking about his first feature narrative directorial, Rosario. Directed by Felipe, with script by Alan Trezza, Rosario is the story of a Wall Street stockbroker, Rosario Fuentes, who returns to her grandmother's apartment after her grandmother's sudden death. While sorting through her grandmother's belongings, Rosario uncovers a horrifying secret. There's a hidden chamber filled with occult artifacts tied to dark generational rituals. As supernatural occurrences plague her, Rosario must confront her family's buried secrets and face the truth about the sacrifices and choices they've made over the generations. And when you see this, first thing you're going to wonder is, how can I get an apartment that is that big that it's going to have a hidden chamber in it that is as large as the one that is in this apartment? I neglected to ask Felipe about that. But in our conversation, he kind of gives me answers that will suffice. And this is a fascinating conversation with Felipe as we delve into the themes of the film, which blend horror with heart and a touch of dark humor, courtesy of screenwriter Alan Trezza, as the story focuses on generational sacrifice and cultural roots. The underlying theme of sacrifice, specifically the sacrifices parents and grandparents make for their children to succeed, deeply resonated with Felipe, which drew him to this script to make as his first feature directorial. As we explore the making of Rosario, you'll hear Felipe discuss the unique visual language created by production designer Carlos Osorio and cinematographer Carmen Cabana, as Felipe emphasizes the use of practical effects, including handcrafted prosthetics, to create a tangible, visceral experience. This truly is a visual feast, thanks to the work of Carlos and Carmen, I have to tell you. Designed to feel tangible and real, there is careful attention paid to texture and detail. It's very tactile when you look at it. It's almost as if you can feel what you're seeing on screen. Using polished, vibrant colors instead of typical gritty horror look, they have created a more sophisticated visual grammar that highlights the film's themes of sacrifice and cultural identity. And the color palette and the set design, which even incorporates trinkets from Felipe's own grandmother's house, were meant to reflect the raw, organic elements of the cultural and religious background of the story. And yes, you'll hear me ask him if he returned the items to his grandmother's house. I'm not telling you the answer. You're going to have to listen and find out. This deliberate visual approach, it sets the film apart from traditional horror aesthetics, making the visual experience as important to the storytelling as the narrative itself. Filmed in Colombia and reflective of Felipe's own cultural heritage, not only provided creative control over the set design, but it allowed for Paolo Mayombe cultural consultants to come on board the production so they could authentically represent the religious and cultural elements of the story. This is how dedicated to authenticity Felipe is with this production. So take a listen as director Felipe Vargas talks about the visual feast, Rosario. Hi, Felipe.
Hey, how are you? Thank you so much for taking the time to chat.
Thank you so much for making this film. I didn't know what to expect, and as I started watching this, I was gobsmacked. Just this film is so visually visceral. This revolves around the intensity and the majesty of this film. It falls on your production designer, on Carlos Osorio, and on your DP, on Carmen Cabana. This, I would not have expected such a polished look for a film of this nature. I would have thought, as most directors would have done, they would have gone grittier, more into an anamorphic kind of look. You and Carmen, with the lighting and the visual grammar, go into the polish that really accentuates with your use of color and saturation, your reds, your greens, your yellows. So we have the metaphoric stop, go, caution that celebrates Carlos's work and the incredible set dress, especially in Grandma's apartment, which is a treasure trove of visual eye candy. A beautiful film, Felipe. Beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the kind words. Godsmacked. I hadn't heard that one before, and that's a great reaction to the film. And I was blessed to have an incredible production designer and cinematographer, and I hope we created a kind of a unique visual language that we haven't seen as much in horror before. So, very proud of the team.
Yeah, this is a visual grammar, a visual language that you don't expect to see in horror. And when it does pop up, it sets your film apart from the rest of the pack, as does your story here. This is a great story and script that Alan Trezza delivered. So I'm curious, when you got the script and you decided you were going to direct this, what jumped out at you as why you wanted to direct this one?
Mm-hmm. So I read Alan Trezza's script and I was blown away. It was one in my short films, which was body horror. It started through a sort of young child's perspective and expanded from there. It had creature effects and amazing monsters. It had humor. Alan Trezza is hilarious. He's known for his horror comedy scripts. But it also had a lot of heart. It had this very powerful underlying theme that I think kind of it really added an extra layer to the horror, which was this idea of sacrifice, of the sacrifices that parents and grandparents make for their kids to move forward and succeed. So that was something that struck me very deeply, and it was really the thing that I latched on to.
I love the generational aspect that we get through the Palomayombe. I love that family history, the lore, the ritualistic nature of it. And to have it presented in this format, it's not just slapped up there with ghosts and goblins and ghouls popping up. There is a method to the madness which you bring to life through these visuals and the incredible, incredible prosthetic makeup. Wow. How much of this did you do in camera practically versus CGI or just visual effects?
We wanted to make a film that felt tangible and real, that you could live in it, that the actress could step in and she felt like she was there. She would feel cold and she would feel the worms. Although that part she didn't like, getting covered in worms. But it was one of those things where we just put a lot of handcrafted detail into the film. I grew up making these special effects prosthetics since I was a kid. I would, you know, create the kind of handmade ones for my dog that was a movie monster, or I would, you know, do facial prosthetics on my cousins, missing eyes and missing limbs. So I always loved that stuff. And I was blessed with a really amazing team that just brought it to the next level. All of the creatures in the movie are real. Of course, there'll be some invisible VFX augmentation.
Sure.
That just take it to the next level.
Yeah, I mean, the prosthetics all is just spectacular, and it really feeds into the ancient organic nature of what is unfolding. And this is also where Carlos's production design and the set dress is so important, because of the organic tactile nature of what we're seeing in Abuela's kitchen, in Abuela's house. And then as we go behind, you know, instead of what the man behind the curtain, no, now we got something else behind a curtain. And it is so real. And that's where it becomes so visceral. So I applaud you for doing this so diligently, working so diligently with the practical in-camera physical prosthetics, because it heightens this entire viewing experience.
Thank you. Now, for me, it was, we always talked about texture, and this religion, Palo, which you brought up, it has the most incredible organic textures, the earth, the dirt, the iron, the skull, the bones, all of that is so real and raw, and that reflected in the monster, it reflected in Abuela's house. I raided my own grandmother's house and brought all these little trinkets to put in the kitchen and the living room. So it really wanted to reflect this culture and this religion and every little detail. So that was really the concept behind it.
Did you return the things to grandma's house?
I did. I put them in a nice suitcase. She said, "Good, take care of them." And I listened to my grandmother, so took good care of them.
Don't we all? That's one of the things that strikes me about your character of Rosario, aka Rose, since she wants to modernize herself, is she kind of dismisses her grandmother. And, you know, that's a generational thing that rarely happens. You might dismiss your parents, but your grandparents you generally remain close to and gravitate towards and listen to. So it was interesting to see Rose not doing that until it was too late.
Mm-hmm. The whole story at its heart was Rosario's sort of rejection and estrangement, not just from her grandmother, but from her culture,
yeah,
from her past, from her roots, from where she came from. And the film's journey is her kind of re-understanding those or acknowledging she has to survive that night. She has to confront these roots and these family secrets that she's buried really deep down. So that was kind of the overarching idea that was Rose's journey, really. Mm-hmm. Rose to respond. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How challenging was the casting for this film? You have a wonderful cast. I mean, you have Emerald as Rosario. David Desmalchian as Joe, with his air fryer obsession, is incredible. He's so much fun to watch. And of course, you bring in Jose as Rosario's dad, Oscar. And that is like a wonderful casting coup for a film like this. And then poor Diane as Elena, a brave woman. Did she get hazard pay, by the way, for enduring?
Did she what?
Did she get hazard pay for enduring?
We buried her alive. She was in these heavy, heavy prosthetics in these very dark places doing acrobatics. She was an incredible, incredible monster. And she just has this intense, very serious presence. You speak to her and she just has this gravitas. So that was the role that I think was the most elaborate to cast. We probably saw 500, 1,000 potential Elenas, and Diana just blew us away. You mentioned David. David is, I mean, I've been a huge fan. It was really a blessing to work with him. He played Dungeons and Dragons with one of the producers, so they knew each other. He gave him a ring. Want to come to Columbia for a week? He said, sure. So we got really lucky working with David. And Emerald, I mean, is just the star of this movie from from minute zero to 90. She's in this film, and she'd never done a horror film before. This was her first horror film, and it's a big ask, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Covered in blood and gore and worms and dirt and run and all this stuff, and get chased by dogs, too. And she was game for it. I knew her from her work. She just had this confidence and this humor and this no-nonsense that I thought would really translate well. So we were very lucky to have her on board.
I'm just amazed at the cast. And as I said, David, I am so familiar with his work over the years, and he is very chameleonic in a lot of what he does. And he brings that touch of lightness, but also the quirk with a cough and that pops in there, and this whole air fryer routine. It makes you wonder. It's very ambiguous as we see the story unfold. And you want to know, is he involved, you know, as part of this? What is it? I do have an important one, Felipe. Your location, you shot this, but for the New York street scenes, you shot this in Columbia. How important was it to you to shoot this in Columbia and be immersed in the culture?
So this is a New York story. We had to shoot in New York as well. We did the exterior there, but the bulk of the film was shot in Columbia, which was really full circle for me. I was born there. So to bring my first movie there was really, really special. And to also have this access where to this Palero culture and these Palero consultants and really this country that believes wholeheartedly in the power of Palo in this world was really important to us. So that was special. And it also just gave us, from a production design standpoint, from a creative standpoint, a lot of creative control. We were able to build all of that apartment on a set, on a stage, and have control over every wall, every trinket, every detail.
Job so well done, Felipe. An immersive visual feast. I love it. I love this. I want a sequel.
Oh, man, I do too. Let's get people out there for the weekend and we'll see what happens. Thank you so much for taking the time and for the kind words on the film. I really could tell that you watched it with an attention to detail and a really beautiful perspective. So thank you.
Oh, and thank you, Felipe. And hope we'll talk again in the future.
Absolutely, would love that.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Take care. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
And that was Felipe Vargas talking about Rosario. And Rosario is currently available in select theaters nationwide. So that is all the time we have today. No show next week because it's Memorial Day. But join me again on Monday, June 2nd. When you'll hear from more filmmakers talking movie magic. In the meantime, make sure to check out the website, behindthelensonline.net, to see and hear many new exclusive interviews, which are up and out right now, with more for your consideration Emmy interviews popping up this week. A whole lot of stuff on Cross, a bunch of stuff on The Boys. Two great series, so you may want to start binging those and get ready to hear all of these artisan interviews that are going to be out this week. So, until June 2nd, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.